See, we farm that my father and mother lived on for most of their farming life was in the town of Keller, just across the line from Marshfield. Before that, we lived Mrs. Richards now lives, which is up the road just before you get to Allen Stevens. The road goes to the left, you know, goes up there about half a mile. Mm-hmm. We lived up there. It's now the end of the road. But it joined this farm down in the valley that we had later, the town of Cabot. They come together from the hill. So that I must have lived down there about 10 years. And we lived on that farm all those years until my folks moved into the village about 1935, I think. But we still own the farm. Two of my brothers and I rented the farm for my father, even while he was on it a while. And then when he moved off, we kept on running it. We bought it then. And about the same time, we bought this farm from him. He had both places. He never used this one very much. Sort of picked this one up almost by accident. It had been in the family for many years, and then it went out of the family. I may have told you this before, I don't know. my grandfather was a twin, and his brother stayed on the farm. His name is Levi, and my grandfather's name is Eli. That's why we call this the Levi. This farm is the Levi, Gibson Farm. His son, Edwin, stayed on the farm and ran it for many years until he retired. And then his daughter, Ruth, stayed on. She had married a young chap by the name of Dwino, Fred Dwino. And they had not been here very long before the flu epidemic struck. And he died. It was the second epidemic, not the first one. The first one was in the fall of 18. The next one, as I remember, was in 1920. She could not run the farm alone. So soon thereafter, she sold it. And it was out of the family for maybe a couple of years in there. And my father picked it up because he discovered that there was a mortgage on it that was held by the Federal Land Bank, and he was doing work for the Federal Land Bank, and so he bought it with a fellow in Cabot who also worked there. And then the fellow in Cabot sold his share to my father, one of my uncles. And then soon thereafter, that uncle sold to my father, so that all this took place within the 20s.
Yes.
And came to that one back in the family. Well, so this was sort of a reserve place, and we used to pasture our cows up here in the summer and keep them down the other place in the winter. Mm. Well, whenever I was looking for jobs, for example, in the winter of 1926, I had the measles of all things. I assumed that I'd had them early. Mm-hmm. The family lived across the way from us. I was then the headmaster of the school in Grove, New Hampshire. Big family. They had them one by one spread out. And apparently I picked it up fine. And was I sick? I had no notion I had the measles. I'd come over to my parents for spring vacation and came down with them over there. And Pauline Burbank's father, Pauline Welch's father, came down to the doctor from Cabot. Mm-hmm. And he said, this is the measles. I was practically out of my mind, you know. Well, the result was that it took me a long time to recover. I went back to work, but I remember climbing stairs in the school building, and I'd have to sort of huff and puff to get up the top of the stairs. So I decided to quit school business, and I had no job. And so, but again, the point is that we weren't worried about this. We had this farm up here. We think we could make a living on it anyway. We'd make it. So Helen and I bought raspberries and blackberries and set them out that year up here. Mm-hmm. But as I got to feel better, of course, in the spring, really get back to normal, I decided to go back in school work. So I went to Wallingford and took up a job down there, and for there 4 years. And then the depression broke. Had broken actually early in that, and I decided to better go and get a doctor than going to get one. So right in the depression went off down in New York. We weren't worried about a living after that, even though we had no money. I had to borrow money to do this for it. We just always figured, that's fine, we can go back and we can scrape a living out of this. And you know, it makes all the difference in the world. Because I had a lot of of guys that I knew who were scared stiff that they might not have a job. As a matter of fact, it was interesting that the reaction Helen was mentioning the other day of the people that got to know us at Columbia. There was a lot of young couples around, just like us, who were working for doctors, you know, and husband and wife were there. And we had these three kids. One was five and the other was two. And here they saw these three kids on the verge of starvation, didn't have a job. And they were so relieved, finally, when they heard that I picked up this job up in New Hampshire. Because they feel, well, after all, they're not going to have to be on the bread line. Mm-hmm. And we had not been aware that they were so concerned. But when it was all over, they saw we had a job, then they said, well, how much relieved they were. Because they thought, this poor family going to be in a bad way. Well, if we'd been in the city and there was no place to fall back on, we would have been worried stiff, you see. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes a tremendous difference in the outlook of person. I think that's one reason maybe the farm people have tended over the years to feel independent. Mm-hmm. Perhaps more so than they really were, but they just had that feeling actually.
That your basic needs are taken care of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can get a living if you need to. It may not be much of a living, but you're not going to starve. Mm-hmm. We if we had to, could raise the food we need and scrape along and pick up odd jobs in there. Mm-hmm. And I have an idea that our grandchildren would have some of that same feeling. They know how to do things on the farm. They don't do something now, of course, but if they have to, they can. Mm-hmm. They're taking care of animals, and they're sugaring, they've got wood and all this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I would assume that over the years that would tend to carry over and give them some feeling of confidence. After all, if worse comes to worse, we can get back and survive. Mm-hmm. If you're the city, you simply can't do that. You haven't got anything you can do. You can scrounge around for a job, if a job is there, but when there are 16 million unemployed, as there were during the Depression, jobs are terribly scarce.
Right. Yeah.
And even now, with 5-6% unemployment, it's pretty hard to find.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's, you use the word landed, that's extensive literature.
Yeah. Do you have any emails to him about, particularly being in Vermont?
What?
No, just, is it different from any other people that you see being landed? What does it mean to be landed here rather than, in Virginia or California or China? Or?
Well, I don't know about China. I would think that it would be more nearly like the situation in the mountains of Carolinas and West Virginia than in our West, where the holdings are so much larger and had to be if you were going to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't make a living in Montana on a small farm like this, which was very fortunately situated in.
Mm-hmm.
And in California, you have a very intensive kind of agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, there's still some areas where it's a little less so, but you know, by and large, it's mm-hmm. terribly intensive and a high capital investment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to be sure, it's getting to be that way here. Dairy farming is terribly expensive in terms of mm-hmm. getting started.
Mm-hmm.
But we've talked with people in Saskatchewan, particularly. We've got to know some families there quite well. And it seems to me they have an outlook that is very similar to the outlook of farmers here.
Mm-hmm.
Their basic interests are different, because they are a large wheat growers. I mean, they have large acreage.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily wealthy people, but they have large acreage to do it. They need work on a smaller scale. But they seem to, being close to the land apparently affects their thinking.
And it's affected your thinking.
Oh, I was getting a question about that.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking something to you.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought of myself as being a farmer, really, even though I haven't acted as a farmer for a long time.
Then why do you think of yourself as a farmer?
I just grew up that way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's hard to say, but when you spent the first as I did, 16, 17 years to, on a farm, and then being related to one ever since. When my two brothers and I were running the farm, we did not live on it, but we were responsible for getting the help to run it and financing it and taking the losses. We haven't made any money with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we get very much involved in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We become concerned about cattle, we become concerned about milk prices, about crops, the weather. You pay attention to the weather, you know.
Is that why in your little diary you're so concerned with the weather, do you think? Is that a farm boy's diary that you keep?
Well, no, I wouldn't say it was the farm boy. I didn't begin doing that until after we were making sugar on this farm.
Mm-hmm.
While we were in college, we began doing that. Well, we see it's a little hard to get separated out because we kept sugaring on the other farm. My father was a superb sugar maker. He could make terrific good sugar. And so we kept on making sugar down there right up to the time we sold the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And then our two kids, the two boys, and Jane to some extent, went to making sugar themselves as little kids. They had an outdoor arch for them. They built a stone arch over here. The first time they did, when they were about the 5th or 6th grade, I guess, along in mind.
Mm-hmm.
So that been involved in some kind of farming operation almost all the time of these years.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they got bigger, they went to, they put up their own sugar house and were tapping maybe 100 trees, and they kept increasing that. Finally bought a small evaporator, a very good one for them.
Mm-hmm.
And they made the sugar then, and they'd take time out of school in the spring. Actually, that's the Johnson school, unless the weather was terrible, they couldn't sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And then as they got still bigger, we kept expanding, and finally when Helen and I bought the farm where Belmont and Kroll live, we remodeled the horse barn, as I pointed out last night, and made that into a sugar house. And this time, we were operating on a pretty good size sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept that up for quite a long time. We quit 4, 5, 6 years ago on a big scale, but almost every year we've done some sugar.
Mm. Mm.
So that I never really gotten away from it,
actually. Yeah. And you also brought yourself back to the farm, or back to...
You mean to retire?
Well, in the sense that you brought Goddard Seminary to...
Oh.
I mean, so that you were back in your place, you're much closer to your place than you were before.
Yeah, I suppose from one point it's a little unusual for a person it is unusual to have the opportunity to do the kind of thing that I did as a profession,
mm-hmm.
so close to where my home had been.
Mm-hmm.
If I'd stayed in high school work, that wouldn't have been so unusual. Here's Charlie Burbank down here in Plainfield. He came from Walden, so he's not very far.
Mm-hmm.
But he runs a very conventional school. But to be involved in an experimental college so close to him is quite unusual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I suppose it's unlikely to happen.
Yeah.
Certainly wasn't true of Bennington. Wasn't true of Sarah Lawrence. So people didn't clap at those. In fact, I can't believe that Hinton didn't come from Putney. But that's almost accidental in a way, you see.
Do you think it's really accidental?
Well, actually, my involvement in Goddard was accidental. In this way, that I had intended to be a superintendent of schools. My graduate work was a large part of it, was in education administration. Having in mind that I would be a student of schools. Well, I wound up on this job in London, New Hampshire. And I lost the job in Massachusetts because I had a doctorate. I hadn't had a doctorate, so I was told I thought this guy probably, you know, they referred to as being overeducated, what they meant being impractical, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, so I landed up in New London, New Hampshire, and there, you see, I discovered, I heard about it, the junior college idea. I really saw it at first hand.
Mm-hmm.
And that was accidental. Because I got involved in the possibility of junior college, where then I got thinking about what could you do with God.
Mm-hmm.
That was accidental.
Mm-hmm. Do you know when you're about to move on to the next step? Do you know when those accidents happen that kind of open up your mind to a new or something that stimulates your mind and then you start talking to people? Are you aware of them? Or does that matter to you?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. You mean that, was I aware in the spring of 1935 that something was about to happen to me?
Or that if you kind of approach it in a certain way that it would make a difference later on? Or that you can move in that direction, that there was a new direction to move in?
Well, let me put it this way. If when I went to New London, New Hampshire, I was, one of the reasons I was attracted to it was because they said they wanted a progressive school.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, this is a new high school, we really have a chance to do something. We did quite a lot, I must say. I was very fortunate, the faculty had a very small group. We had a good time together.
Yeah.
But there were certain sort of limitations. But at that point, I was not thinking at all about the possibility of starting a college or being involved in a college.
Mm-hmm.
It's only that here was a chance to do something in an area that I wanted to do something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that when I gave up the job in New London, that I had no idea of becoming involved in God. That's something developed during that summer.
Mm-hmm.
There's another thing where I think that having the land to fall back on gives you a sense of security. I gave up several jobs in the course of my life, and always not knowing what the next job was going to be. When I gave up my job in Plymouth, decided not to be there. I didn't have a job.
Sounds so familiar.
But I got one spring, see, so
right.
But some people were scared to death, you know, that would happen. I gave up a job in Wallingford, and I didn't have a job. I gave up a job in Groton, New Hampshire, and didn't have a job. Well, I probably wouldn't have done that unless I'd known that, gee, if worse comes to worse, we can get back here on the good old farm and do something about it. Nobody was living here then, so though I knew this place was available.
Mm-hmm.
We could live on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I didn't think those things through very far, actually.
Mm-hmm. Except you knew when something had come to an end. I mean, even some people don't even know that. In a way, that's a rare gift or a skill or a perception. You know, to say, especially when there's nothing immediately on the horizon, you can see something happening. The skill to be able to say, okay, that's it.
Yeah, of course, in one's early years, they tend to move by ambition.
Mm-hmm.
The end of my first year of teaching, I enjoyed it. I learned a tremendous amount out of it. I had a very conservative principal, but he was in many ways a very effective one.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that I wanted to go on and do something else. I kind of wanted to be a principal myself.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, I hoped to get married.
Mm-hmm.
And I was earning $1,550 that year, and I figured I got to earn a little bit more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I earned $2,000 next year. I think Helen got $1,000 as a teacher that year. Well, then we were there 2 years, and we liked the town. Hyde Park was a great place for us as a young couple. We liked the people, and they seemed to accept us very well. But I got ambitious, thought I'd have a bigger school. So this opening came up, this bigger school opened in New London, in Groton, New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
New Hampshire. Well, I wasn't, I didn't, as Helen said the other day, I didn't seem to relate so well. I don't quite why. I got along all right, and I could have stayed, and I liked the people, but I felt like kind of a foreigner, in a way. It was a mill town, and I had never been in a mill town before.
Mm.
And it's a different ethos in the town, you know.
Mm.
And the churches were not churches I was familiar with. The Baptist Church, for example. Although later I went to a Baptist church in New London, New Hampshire. That was the only real church there. But it was a different sort of situation. So, but the reason I quit was because I said I just didn't have any drive, any energy. I just thought, well, get back on the farm and I'll get some. But the moves were made because I wanted to get ahead, whatever that meant. But then you begin to reach the point where that isn't, the getting ahead doesn't take that form. You want to achieve, I guess, in addition to getting ahead. That's it, or besides getting ahead.
And what is the drive now?
Same one. Not to get ahead, that, as far as I was concerned, quit once I became president of the college. No job that I wanted, ever wanted, besides that one after I was on the job. If you'd offered me the presidency of Bennington, I wouldn't have even looked at it. If you'd offered me the presidency of Bennington earlier, I would have been the tickle of death to tackle it, you know. Or I would have been glad to have been the Commissioner of Education of Vermont. Probably couldn't have done the job, but that's beside the point.
What about if they'd offered you the president of Harvard University?
Oh, no. Not afterwards had gone.
I see.
Because to me, that was it was a great place to work. We had more possibilities and more any place going. The great thing we lacked was money.
Mm-hmm.
But probably we were able to move as fast as we should have moved anyway.
Mm-hmm.
He had more money, God knows it. And so, in a sense, it's that same sort of interest that I still have. I've always been interested in Marshfield in some way or other, although I haven't been involved in it for a long, long time, and even then as a kid, of course. I'm interested in educational change. I'm interested in a better society. All of those sort of things. So I've got involved in these various activities that hopefully lead in that direction, such as civil liberties union, Planned Parenthood, you know, the council on the humanities and public issues, these various education institutions. I wasn't seeking the bicentennial committee. As a matter of fact, I sort of shied away from it.
How did it happen?
Hmm?
How did it happen?
Schleichman asked me. Jerry Healy asked me if I would be on it, and I said, "Well, yes, I will." And then he said, "Will you be chairman?" And I said, "Well, no, I don't know." But then, when the committee assembled, it looked like that nobody else wanted to do it. There was Lois and John Lampton and his granddaughter Suzanne Lawrence. Well, just came to one meeting, and Arthur Gilman, who couldn't do it, he'd be a logical guy if he could, because he's a college student and off down at Brown, so that ruled him out. And, so that wound up. One of these unpremeditated things, you know.
Yeah.
Now, once you get into it, you feel, well, you ought to go ahead and do what you can.
Yeah.
I think it has great possibilities in the bicentennial community.
Yeah, yeah. To do what, Tim?
As an educational force, in the broadest sense, and perhaps of bringing people together more than they have been done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, helping, getting more people to be aware of the advantages that we have in this area. At the same time, I'd like to get them to be aware of the importance of the basic principles on which the Declaration stood and which our Vermont Constitution stood.
Why are these important documents?
Why?
Yeah.
Because I think we're constantly in danger of losing them.
Mm.
I think we're constantly in danger of having our freedom restricted, our civil rights constricted,
mm.
me. And people talk a lot about the being conservative, you ought not to get away from basic principles. And when they, a lot of people talk that way, are the ones who are getting away from the basic principles. Mm. I think of government, mm. Our own government.
Is there more danger now than there used to be, do you think?
Well, no, I don't think, relatively speaking, probably not. But the danger is always there. Mm. Well, it says eternal vigilance is the price of liberty, mm. And that really seems to be true. Mm. You see all these encroachments on freedom of liberty. You have only to see what the Nixon administration did throughout all of its years. We've been consistently deceived by the government, not only in the Nixon administration, but earlier, as a matter of fact, but more so during the Clinton administration than in the other one, I think. So we could, I think, if that trend continues, you could move toward a totalitarian form of society, which is anything but pleasant. Mm. Mm. So I just think we ought to help people become more aware of the blessings, if you want to put those terms, that we really have. Mm. And I think the Bicentennial Committee can do, in a way, that sort of thing. I don't think we can push it too hard.
Sounds like you're a county agent again.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's still opportunities to make contributions in a small way. This idea of the community educational agent, you know, that Mike sent, mm-hmm. It was an idea that I thought of one time at a meeting of the State Education Advisory Council.
Oh, I didn't know that at all. Do you realize that?
Huh?
When I've been calling you a community educational agent, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Well, we were trying to think of how effective the Title III had been. You know, Title III was set up to bring about changes in the public schools, mm-hmm. through making grants to schools or persons within schools. Mm-hmm. To carry on projects that would be, use the terminology of the Act, innovative and exemplary.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have done this now for a long time. They've tried different approaches. And so we talk about how do you really bring about change in the school system, mm-hmm. on a statewide way. And it occurred to me that one thing that ought to be tried, would be worth trying, would be to have something that we call a community educational agent. They have shortened that. They call it the community education agent, as if it was concerned with the education of the community. But in reality, it was to be, again, the county agricultural agent idea, the guy, except with modifications,
mm-hmm.
the function of this person would be to find out what's going on in the schools,
mm-hmm.
and then interpret that to the community, get the reaction of the community, and carry the reactions of the community back to the school. So you have this process going on like this all the time, mm-hmm. interchange in action all the time,
mm-hmm.
and that out of this it would be possible to generate changes in the school. One of the reasons we have difficulty generating change is we don't have adequate communication.
Mm-hmm.
People, for example, talking about the Burbank situation, had the craziest notions about what we had in mind to do,
mm-hmm.
utterly unfounded. But if we had good communication, I think that we would have made the change. We would have a different kind of principle.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, and so the council thought it was a good idea, and therefore encouraged the superintendents and others around the state to put in proposals. And along comes John O'Brien in his first year, and submits the proposal to have a county community education agent. You got me back on county. So that's what Mike is supposed
mm-hmm.
to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he's doing a lot of work.
He works very hard.
Yeah.
He probably does more work than any other community education agent for him. But he's, as somebody said, he's not married, he has a lot of energy.
Mm.
I think he can spend his evenings at this as well as
right.
days.
Yeah.
I don't know whether the main objective is going to be achieved or not,
mm.
of facilitating change. But it occurred to me that last night, that if he really can squeeze some time out, apparently like to do that. Mm-hmm. It may be that through the bicentennial, we can get some things going in the schools that otherwise you couldn't get going. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's through the change we come about through the ways of teaching history and the social sciences and literature, even, I think. Mm-hmm. Good question.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought of just going back into a classroom and seeing what that would be like at Twinfield or something? Have you ever done that too?
Yeah, I fantasied once that I'd kind of like to be principal of the elementary school in Montreal.